Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Acting Deputy Editor Sophia Wilson. Now, let's kick off with an apology, listeners. Those of you who tune in each week will know we broke a promise last week. In the episode before the Monaco Yacht Show, we absolutely vowed to bring you a podcast from the Monaco Yacht Show, but we didn't do that. But to be fair to Sophia, my co-host, it was mainly my failure. Sophia was all ready to go and had actually lugged a massive microphone around half of Monaco, ready to record the podcast. But I had simply forgotten how crazy the show was. So, an apology.
Yeah, I don't like the "we" that was mentioned in this. I was fully committed.
Yeah, it was. I don't know what I was thinking, really, making that promise. It was massively naive of me, as if I haven't been to the Monaco Yacht Show before. Of course, it's crazy. I mean, it's just making appointments in Monaco is, or making any arrangements is almost futile, because getting around the show is a chore in itself. Any appointments, everyone's half an hour late for any appointment that you do make. Boat tours suck at least 2 hours out of your day, even more if you've got to tender out to them. Then there's the stop and chats. Obviously, you walk around, you got to stop and chat to about 65 people before you get to your destination, then apologize profusely for being late. Oh man. So it's and so trying to squeeze a podcast into all of that was just a silly idea. So yeah, Sophia gave me a bad look. And I learnt my lesson, never to make silly promises again.
My microphone had a lovely tour around Monaco. It went for dinner at the SAS Cafe. It actually ended up in Nikki Beach as well. It had a lovely Monaco yacht show.
And these aren't small microphones either. These are very heavy, chunky microphones. So there was a bit of exercise for you there, Sophia. Not that you needed it after doing 20,000 steps a day at the Monaco yacht show.
Yeah, but you, to be fair, your steps a day were slowed down by the plastic boot, which still exists.
Yeah, my enormous plastic boot on account of my ruptured Achilles tendon. So as well as the 65 stop and chats between each appointment, you've also got to explain 4,000 times a day why I'm wearing a big plastic boot on my leg. So I managed to condense the entire sorry story into about 3 words by the end of the show. And then people just looked at me blankly, like they had no idea what I was talking about. But I couldn't keep telling the story. It was too hard.
Did you make up a new story? I think you maybe should have had a few different options to work with.
Yeah, I thought about that. But then again, that just required even more effort. And then I think I just didn't have it in me. I just didn't have it to lie 6,000 times a day. So, I mean, of course, apart from all the appointments, boat tours, seeing everybody, the firefighting you occasionally have to do. There's the evening events, of course, and then you've got to go home, change, go out again. So my wife laughs at me every time I'm packing for Monaco because I take so many shirts. But you have to run a 2-shirt-a-day strategy. It's the only way you can do it. And I despite packing all these shirts, I still had to do some laundry. But you were staying out of town, Sophia, so it was a little bit trickier for you.
Yes, I perfected the the change in a loo strategy, which is, as you can imagine, the super glamorous lifestyle that everyone imagines us living. But yes.
Yeah, we had a little, as well as the change in the loo strategy, we've also, on the Boat International stand, we had this small cupboard that was used for everything from lunches to... occasionally even storing something. But you'd see a staff member walk into the cupboard in one outfit and then come out 5 minutes later in a completely different outfit, because that was the only opportunity they had to change clothes before some evening function.
Yeah, the cupboard did see many things, I think.
yeah, the cupboard, yeah. It's had a long week for that cupboard. So because we missed last week's podcast, we've missed a ton of news. I mean, there's been so much going on from the show, press releases, new launches, deliveries, bits and pieces like that. So we've decided to forego the interview this week. There won't be an interview because we're going to double down on the news and do a bit of a news special, which we'll get to in a minute. But normal service will resume next week with our interview, and we've got a great one within Marsat. Anyway, so Sophia, what were your highlights from the Wanaka Yacht Show?
I had a few. I think one was definitely sitting down with Dr. Al-Bawani, which will be our owner's interview in the December issue. So I'm just frantically trying to write that and turn it around this week so that our production manager, Simon, doesn't shout at me too much because it's late. I'm sure most listeners are familiar with his name. He's obviously the owner of Ocean Co and investor in Turquoise Yacht. And then he also has his own 32-meter yacht as well. As you can imagine, he was fascinating to talk to, and I don't want to spoil the feature for the magazine that I'm currently working so hard on. But one thing that really stuck with me is that he's thinking about potentially buying an old Ocean Co, maybe kind of 15, 20 years old, and refitting it. And part of his reasoning for this was environmental. And I thought it was an interesting idea. I think it's very easy to get excited about all the new technologies that are out there. And we're obviously covering some different bits of that in the news coming up. But should we be thinking a bit more maybe about what is already on the water and what we could be doing with the fleet that already exists? Stu, I don't know whether you've got any thoughts on this.
The toss-up, I mean, basically the green. So is it greener to refit a yacht than build a new one?
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing it is. I don't really know. But my instinct is that it is, because, I mean, what in a rebuild, often, you know, you lengthen a bit, you might add a bit of deck or a superstructure or do bits and pieces like that. But that's got to be less impactful than starting from scratch, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think so too. It might be something interesting to discuss further on another podcast, hopefully with someone with more expert insight than we've got. But it was an interesting idea. You know, there was a lot of noise at this year's show about green and environmental, and which is great to see the industry really embracing that. But it is interesting to think about the fleet that already exists and what we should also be doing with that, rather than just constantly thinking about the new thing. So that really stuck with me. And then I think I also mentioned on the podcast before Monaco that I was really looking forward to seeing Victorious. And I was actually fortunate enough to be shown around by her owner, who was incredibly generous with his time. I won't go over the backstory again because I did a couple of weeks ago, and you can read it in the full yacht report, which will be coming out. But what was super interesting is that he actually built his own yard in Turkey to complete the project. He's definitely now got the bug for it, so I'd expect to see some more yachts coming out from AK Yacht soon. But it made me thinking about other owners that have had to do similar things. I know, for example, the owner of Blue Denise, which is actually going to be our cover yacht for our November issue, which is the refit special, has ended up doing it twice. Stu, I don't know whether you know any other owners that have kind of taken matters into their own hands.
Yeah, a couple. The Classic Alicia was done that way. Shimara was, sort of. It's happened a few times, because I think with big rebuild projects, owners sometimes get a bit scared about putting it into a traditional shipyard, because once it's in there and it's been taken apart and it's back to bare steel, they worry that the shipyard kind of has them by the short and curlies, for lack of a better phrase. But so some take it upon themselves to do all the work. And then, of course, is the classic example of a shipyard going under during the build of your boat. So the only way you're going to get it finished is if you take over the shipyard. And that happened with the Fitzroy, your Escapade, and various other boats. So that's a slightly sorrier side of the story. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly not completely uncommon, like a few examples you've mentioned there of owners renting the shed space and bringing in the subbies and completing, you know, doing the project themselves.
Yeah, well, as I say, it'll be interesting to see whether he does go on to build more. I certainly got the sense he'd got the bug for it. What were some of your highlights, Stu, from the show, apart from hobbling?
Yeah, occasionally sitting. I really enjoyed my moments of stationary action. But it was just so nice seeing everyone. Everyone had a smile on their faces. You know, and it's a buoyant time for the business, as we've, you know, spoken about many times on the podcast at the moment. There's loads of business being done at the moment. So the industry's happy. There were lots of owners around. So talking about owners, we had a big party for them on the 80-meter Artifact on the Wednesday night, which is just delightful. Again, you know, quite emotional just because it was, you know, apart from the World Super Awards a few weeks before that, it was just the biggest and best opportunity to get the club together. So it's great seeing everyone again. And then, yeah, it's, you know, catching up with industry colleagues. And then I was really lucky because I got to leave the show on Sunday morning on the 55-meter yacht Mosquito, built by Heeson, which was at the show. So I'd never done that before. So Heeson kindly invited me to cruise out of Monaco Harbour on that boat. We went down the coast to Cannes, had some lunch at a beach club. But actually, while we were having lunch, this horrendous storm rolled in and we were kind of undercover. But the rest of the beach club was absolutely wiped out. So people got absolutely drenched. We got it. But I, of course, I didn't appreciate at the time that a few hours later, when I'm sitting in Nice Airport, that the entire air traffic of the entire south coast of France and half of Italy is all bunged up because of this storm. So, you know, that took a little bit of the gloss off what was a lovely day.
So what time did you get back on Sunday night?
It was very late. And then I can't quite remember, but it was late, a couple of hours later at least than I should have been, because we were sitting in the airplane for an hour and we were boarded an hour late already. But of course, then we land back in the UK and there's a shortage. No one can get any fuel. So I'm thinking, oh God, now how do I get home? So eventually I found an Uber to come pick me up. But that was panic stations, because I thought, because I contacted our regular kind of driver service and they said, Mr. Campbell, sorry, we can't come pick you up. None of our cars are on the road because none of them have any fuel in them. So I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. But I did eventually make it home.
Yeah, it did slightly feel like we returned to kind of UK falling apart in quite spectacular style. But you're going back to France this weekend, so you're escaping again.
Yeah, back to Nice Airport. So we've got an event in Saint-Tropez this weekend on board the classic Talita, which will be just lovely. I love that event. It's very calm and a slightly more relaxed affair than Monaco. But the for our overseas listeners, there's apparently no fuel left in the UK. So you drive past petrol stations and there's queues of people. It's like the 70s. It's unbelievable. Anyway, less best day out of politics. So like we said at the top of the show, we're going to run through a lot of news now instead of our traditional interview. So Sophia, why don't you kick us off with our first story?
Yeah, so we're going to start with the 115-metre Lursen Project Enzo has begun sea trials. We got some amazing pictures of her this week navigating the Kiel Canal, making her way towards the North Sea, where she's now going to undergo extensive sea trials ahead of a delivery in November. The yacht was sold by Maran Yacht and Ship in September 2018 to a repeat Lursen client, and Nuvali Leonard has collaborated with the yard on the project, having previously worked with the owner on their 87-metre yacht. It's described as being family-focused, with various sports and leisure facilities on board, including an extra-large gym on the sky lounge and wellness area on the lower deck. I have a trivia question for you, Stuart.
Oh, God.
Is Project Enzo in or out of the top 25 largest yachts in the world?
Out.
Yes, correct. Just. So number 25 is 123-metre Golden Odyssey for future reference.
Fleet's getting bigger.
It is.
Number two is Turquoise Yachts is to build its flagship called Project Vento. The sale was announced on the eve of the Monaco Yacht Show. It will be launched in 2024 and at 87 metres will not only be Turquoise's flagship, but will also be the largest yacht ever built in Turkey, overtaking Bilgin's Tatiana, I believe. So UK design studio H2 Yacht Design is responsible for both the exterior styling and interior design for the 2,500 gross ton yacht. And this will, believe it or not, will be H2's ninth new build collaboration with Turquoise. They are thick as thieves, those two. H2 just do a great job, as do Turquoise. Lovely lines on this boat. So I'm looking forward to seeing her when she hits the water in 2024. Congratulations to Turquoise and H2.
Yeah, H2 certainly seem to be very busy at the moment, which is great.
Yeah, they're on a roll. Yeah, absolutely.
So moving on, the first 66-metre Benetti B-Now Oasis sold. The yacht is designed by British studio RWD. This is the first of the series to be sold and features the Oasis deck solution seen on the smaller 40-metre Oasis series. The first hull in that series, Rebecca, just picked up a Neptune at the World Super Awards. The Oasis deck dispenses with the more traditional beach club approach and opens the stern completely to create a kind of tiered passage into the sea. Bonetti said it better. With the Oasis deck concept, Bonetti has created a space that goes well beyond the traditional idea of the beach area, giving substance unfulfilled demand in the market for a large social space at the water's edge. A 20 square metre swimming pool will sit in this area and will feature two wings that open port and starboard to increase the size of the water level platform. The boat will seat 14 guests across six staterooms with space for a crew of 13. At 10 knots, the yacht will have a range of 5,000 nautical miles. Bonetti also announced it has sold six of its 37 metre Beyond Explorer yachts.
Yeah, so this is the beach club, the continuing evolution of the beach club. Well, it's not a beach club, it's more a beach area on these Oasis deck models. And it's really, I love it actually, the way it's all open. There's just this kind of free flow between the main saloon and the water. You just hop down a few levels, dive in, and there's a massive pool. Yeah, it's. I think this is going to get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, we did a feature recently on it, didn't we, that Cecile, our editor in the US, put together.
Yeah, it's funny. So, yeah, that's right. So the kind of that feature's online now as well. It's kind of the changing, you know, shape and design of the beach club. So there used to be a working area. Then some bright spark came up with the idea of making it into kind of a disco lounge, you know, water sports area, or just, you know, a bar and a place to relax. And now it's been opened up completely. So there's no enclosed spaces. So, you know, tenders are forward. Or, you know, just in front of this area inside hatches. And then you just have this amazing and quite massive platform over the sea. And the one on the 40 meter, Rebecca, the 40 meter Oasis series is vast. So on this 66 meter, it's going to be absolutely enormous. So next on our news list, Project Y910 is going to be sold at auction. This will be the biggest superyacht ever to be put up for auction. She's asking 25 million euros with Althaus luxury yachting, but will also go into the auction with no reserve set. So I'll chuck in a cheeky 50 quid and see how it goes.
I'm sure your wife would be delighted if that paid off.
Yeah, but honey, I've bought 120 meter superyacht. So the online auction will take place on the 11th of November via online marketplace ConciergeAuctions.com in partnership with Boathouse Auctions. The bidding will remain open until November 23rd. So it's a fascinating project. So Y910 was originally launched as a passenger ship in 1990 and used by the Russian offshore industry before being bought by her current owner, whose ambition was to turn her into this explorer yacht. She's got very classic lines as well. Lovely looking thing. She's massive, 6,000 gross tons, with 1,360 square meters of exterior deck space. And she offers space for 36 guests in 18 cabins alongside 50 crew. She's fully SOLAS compliant and has an ice-classed hull and features a range of 10,000 nautical miles. So there you go. You can buy her now for 25 million euros or bid on her in the auction, which kicks off on the 11th of November. That will be fascinating watching what she eventually sells for, because the potential of the project is profound. And and there's a bit to do on her, you could have 120 meter superyacht in about 18 months, I think. That's the idea.
Yeah, I mean, our online team have just done a roundup of some of the biggest yachts that have ever gone under auction, and it is really interesting reasoning. I mean, sometimes it's for the wrong reasons that they end up under auction, but there's been some pretty large superyachts that have been sold that way.
Yeah, they have. And the prices they go for are really fascinating. So John Caldwell bought Titania at auction, and he told me a few years ago when I interviewed him that he bought her for $36 million or something like that. I can't quite remember the exact price, but he felt guilty because he definitely underpaid for that yacht. It was 63 meter Lurs, and it wasn't terribly old, and he got it for a snip relatively. And Dave Ritchie, the guy who owned it before him, owned an auction house, of course. That's why it ended up in auction. But Dave Ritchie, apparently, John got on very well with him, so he felt quite bad that he got the boat for what the, you know, assume market price would be. Anyway, talking of auctions, Perini Navi has failed to sell for the second time. In the first auction earlier this year, the bankrupted shipyard was listed for €62.5 million. The sale did attract some bids, but all were below the asking price. The second auction, which had a bid deadline of the 29th of September, has also failed, despite the listing price dropping to €53.5 million. So a judge will now decide the terms of and terms and date specifics of the third auction. So reports tell us that Perini Navi was carrying a debt load of €133 million when it was put into administration last year, which is a chunky old debt indeed. So speaking at the Monaco Yacht Show, Ferretti Group boss Alberto Glassi, who was very open in his desire to buy with Massimo Perotti of San Lorenzo the assets of Perini Navi, he said, "I think it's too expensive still because, in my humble opinion, the effort of restarting the company is huge. In a market that's booming like right now, it's very hard to find talent. You have to find talent to give new life to Perini Navi, and where do you find it? I have no idea what is left. Nobody knows if there's anything left but the brands and the buildings. And I believe these businesses are built on the women and men who work there," said Galassi. So the items up for or included in the auction are, well, some of them are two shipyards, land in Pisa, a superyacht under construction, the brands and patents, and 100% share capital of the company and existing legal relationships. So it's a decent package included in that auction, but no bidders, or at least no bidders matching the asking price just yet. So there you go. Will it be third time lucky for Perini Navi? We shall see.
Yeah, it's sad to see that, again, it hasn't gone. Particularly when I was interviewing the captain of Seahawk a few weeks ago, and he's worked on Perini's all his life, and you kind of had a real sense of the Perini community that exists within owners and the people that have worked on them. So it'd be nice to see them find a new buyer.
Yeah, and surely that's the strength of that. But obviously, I understand that the shipyards, the land, the project of the construction, et cetera, but the family of owners Perini have is second to none, and they love the brand. And still, the second-hand market for Perini's is quite strong. You know, people have a real emotional attachment to that brand. So it'll be tragic if it just slides off into obscurity. I really hope it doesn't. And it was great seeing Barak and Fabrizio Scariglia and a few other guys at the Monaco Yacht Show.
Moving back to motor yachts, Lursen is to build a 133-meter superyacht project JASSJ, or is it meant to be pronounced, Stuart? Do you have inside intel on this?
I really don't. And I asked the Lursen guys. I'm not sure they knew either. Jazzage.
Okay, we'll go with Jazzage or JASSJ. I don't know. Anyway, Moran, who negotiated the build contract and will supervise the build, revealed some very limited details at Monaco Yacht Show. It'll be designed inside and out by RWD Design and will have accommodation for a total of 22 guests in 11 cabins. Other standout features include an industry-leading beach club aft, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with their beach club, a full-beam gym, and extensive outdoor spaces for entertaining and relaxation. We'll keep you updated as and when we get any further details as that project progresses, because I'm sure there will be some amazing details to come out.
I think I'm going to go really out on a limb here and say I think that might be RWD's first project with Lursen. I'm going to have to check that after this podcast.
Are you frantically Googling?
Now I'm in serious state of panic, because that might be wrong, but I think that might be right. Anyway, Justin will send me an angry letter.
Yeah, you can add it to your apologies list for next
week. Yeah, I know. The list is long and growing. Meanwhile, Royal Housman is to build a 65-metre sailing yacht known as Project 408. The Ketch-rigged yacht will be designed by Dykstra Naval Architects and Mark Whiteley Design. So it's in the design and engineering phase now, soon to start construction. The yacht will be built in Alustar aluminium and feature a carbon rig. The result, the yard said, will be an enhanced winning potential on the superyacht regatta circuit. Not a lot else, a bit like Jazzage, not a lot else is known about the project at the moment, but we'll bring you updates when we know them.
So moving on, Balietto is to launch a hybrid seawater-powered yacht by 2025. The Italian shipyard is aiming to have the first application of this technology on the water by 2025, but it will have a fully functional scale prototype completed as soon as 2022. Now, I'm going to try and explain technically how this works, so you'll have to bear with me. So the technology works by using a propulsion that involves the implementation of a hydrogen production module that uses filtered and deionized seawater, which produces hydrogen through a system of electrolyzers. These electrolyzers are primarily powered by energy from other renewable sources, such as solar panels or batteries, with the aim of producing as much green hydrogen as possible. Valletta's chief commercial officer, Fabio Amoretto, said in Monaco, "Hybrid for us is already a reality, but if we don't start working and building on this technology now, in 10 or 20 years' time, we'll be left behind." This news follows the introduction of the shipyard's first hybrid offering, which was presented during a virtual press conference at the end of 2022.
Thanks, Sophia. So now I know who to go to when I have any questions about electrolyzers and seawater hydrogen powered yachts.
I may or may not have been relying quite heavily on the script for that bit of information.
While you were trying to wrap your head around that technology, I was frantically Googling RWD and Lursen. They did work on the interior of Al Said, of course, which was 155 meter Lursen. So I did get it wrong, but hey, what's new? Moving back to the sailing side, Wally has revealed a range of 30 meter plus sailing yachts. This all came through at the Monaco Yacht Show. The new designs are part of a strategic push by Wally to redouble efforts on the sailing side. There will be three models over 30 meters, the Wally 110, the Wally 130, and the Wally 150. They will all be designed in-house with naval architecture by Udall Vrolik, while custom features and equipment can be chosen by the owners. Speaking at the show, Fretti Group Chief Executive Alberto Galassi said, "We didn't want to come out with just one model. We want to have performance cruisers that everyone can buy, and we want to give a package that is faster than any other brand, but is also a great cruising boat." So Wally also revealed at the show that it had built models for bigger and smaller versions of its eye-catching Y series, following the debut of the Y200 in Cannes, which was certainly one of the standout boats of that show. And the way where she was sitting in Monaco, actually, it was very clever where they put her, because she was so visible from so many angles. Even at Monaco, that everyone was talking about this 27-meter boat. So the smaller version will be shown at the Dusseldorf Boat Show next year, and details on the bigger one to follow.
So believe it or not, we've finally made it to our last news story. Thanks for sticking with us.
Well done, everybody.
But last but not least, Tansy Yachts has signed a partnership deal with the founder of Sun Deck Yachts, Angelo Casatelli. The new partnership will build steel and aluminium yachts between 35 metres and 60 metres that will be designed by Risa Tansy. So far, two yachts and four projects have emerged from four sets of negotiations, which created the starting point for the partnership. Two new projects, including a 40 metre and a 50 metre, were also unveiled at the show, and details of a 24 metre Explorer project are also expected imminently. The new projects show the clear military vessel inspiration that Tansy, of course, is known for, but a statement also said that they will deliver modern, minimal interiors that are bright, airy and comfortable.
Happy that we're not going to lose the unique styles of Risa from the waters. I mean, he's a brilliant designer. His boats have won World Superyacht Awards in the past. They've got a real following. So happy to know that it's not the end. Far from it. So as well as all these stories, there was lots and lots of very cool concepts unveiled at the show from the likes of Fedship Lursen, Ocean Co, Tankoa, Rossi Navi, and designers, of course, Samsia Giovanni had a great one. We don't, unfortunately, have time to go into all of those. We probably should do a concept special at some point. But anyway, so all these, the stories about all those concepts and all these stories we've mentioned above can be seen on the Boat International website. And as ever, we will have links to them all in the description. So we do have a data story. We don't have an interview, but we do have a data story, which is brought to you, as ever, by Boat Pro, the superyacht industry's leading market intelligence platform.
So we've kept everything Monaco Yacht Show related vaguely so far. So we've done the same with the data. And we're just going to quickly look at some of the numbers from this year's show. There were 101 yachts at this year's show, which was the 30th edition. The years have been slightly skewed because of COVID, but it's the 30th edition. These numbers were slightly down on the 25th anniversary of the show, where there are 124 yachts, but a pretty big increase since the show first started in 1991, when there were just 32 yachts. 37 yachts debuted at the show, including 6 sailing yachts. And even though the number of yachts might have been slightly lower, the LOA is increasing. So there were the average length overall of this year's show was 49 metres, whereas in 2010 it was 45. And at the first show, it was just 32 metres. So as we've already discussed, the fleet is getting bigger and bigger. In terms of a full breakdown, there were 22 yachts between 20 and 40 metres, 36 yachts between 40 and 50 metres, which I think really shows how kind of competitive that area of the market is. 15 yachts between 50 and 70 metres and 14 yachts that were above the 70 metre mark. The largest yacht at this year's show was 108 metre IJE, but she isn't the largest yacht ever to be on display at Monaco, as we had 110 metre Ocean Co Jubilee back in 2019.
Thanks, Sophia. One massive improvement, actually, I thought, on this show was having all those sailing boats lined up together instead of kind of dotted about the place. I thought that had a real impact. I know there are usually a few over there, but to have every single sailing boat lined up alongside each other was great, because it just felt like there were more sailing boats for that reason, instead of being scattered around. So that was a great development, I thought. So there were some really lovely boats on display there. So, Sophia, favourite boat of the show?
Didn't get on that many. I mean, I'm gonna have to say Victorious, because her owner was just so delightful.
And it had a Bentley.
And it had a Bentley on the front. And it had a playroom, which I just think is genius. Anyone with children, I mean, anyone with children in a home has a playroom. Why would you not have a playroom on your yacht? It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I quite agree. I'm going to be boring and say Artifact. You know, I just can't get over that boat. I'm really in love. Victorious was certainly eye-catching. She was right in the middle of the show. So I was talking to the Burgess, Tim from Burgess, who was responsible for putting that Bentley on the front. He said it was quite a nerve-wracking experience watching it being craned on to the foredeck of Victoria's. But yeah, very impactful.
Yeah, I had a similar conversation with Nikki from Burgess, who said, yeah, watching a new Bentley being put on a new yacht is not something she wants to do ever again, potentially.
Yeah, I can well imagine. So, listeners, thank you for tuning in. That brings us to the end of this week's Boat Briefing. Next week, we'll be back to normal service and have an interview for you. But that's it for this week. With thanks to Grace Nielsen for mixing and producing the episode. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.